infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Why don't you ask me what it feels like to be a freak?
The power of a new generation.
Greetings and welcome to the year 2011. You are listening to Savage Science Radio here at Jackalope 105 FM, and I am your host, Tracy Savage. Let's hear some tunes to start this excellent year off right.
Down, tell me I'm wrong.
Well, we made it to the year 2011 with most of the planet still intact. Let's take a look, as promised, at a recap on 2010 and the top 10 science stories of that year. We can start off with number 10, which is the Neanderthal genome that got decoded. Long a topic of scandalous speculation, the occasional interbreeding of early humans and Neanderthals was backed up by DNA evidence this year with the first major draft of the Neanderthal genome. In a May paper in Science, researchers concluded that for those with roots outside of Africa, some 1 to 4% of a person's genetic material likely came from Neanderthals. The find has led to some to propose that Neanderthals be recast in the evolutionary tree as a subspecies of modern humans, Homo sapiens neanderthalensis. The mitochondrial genome has been sequenced in 2008 and solidified the presupposition that our last common ancestor with Neanderthals lived less than 1 million years ago and possibly as recently as 520,000 years ago. The mDNA, however, could neither confirm nor deny that Neanderthals and our human forebears shared a cave bed. With the draft of the genome, researchers have reported seeing Neanderthal genes in well-known people. Former Black Sabbath frontman Ozzy Osbourne, that we just heard, who had his full genome sequenced earlier this year, has some traces of Neanderthal genetics. But Ozzy's caveman quotient turns out to be less than genetic company. GNOME's co-founder, George Church, whose genome revealed about 3 times as much Neanderthal content. And that brings us to number 9, a microbe that lives on arsenic, or does it? It all began with a vague but tantalizing press release. NASA issued a statement in late November about a forthcoming press conference, quote, to discuss an astrobiology finding that will impact the search for evidence of extraterrestrial life, unquote. Speculation that NASA had found ET ran rampant, but the actual finding turned out to be much more down-to-earth. Researchers publishing in Science announced that they had isolated a bacterial strain from California's Mono Lake that can substitute arsenic for phosphorus in a pinch, even taking the arsenic into the structure of its DNA. Phosphorus is one of 6 key nutrient elements that enable life as we know it. No other organism is known to swap out any of the 6 for an element outside the group. Before long, though, independent experts began piping up with complaints and caveats. The evidence, they argued, was insufficient to back up the extraordinary claim. The microbe might simply be sequestering the arsenic rather than incorporating it. As 2000 draws to a close, the toxic issue remains unsettled. Perhaps the new year will bring a resolution. And let's see, number 8, return of the electric car. More than a decade after its EV-1 electric car was quote-unquote killed, General Motors' Chevrolet Volt began shipping in December to car dealerships in California, New York State, Texas, and Washington, D.C. Chevy claims the front-wheel drive 4-passenger Volt can travel up to about 55 kilometers powered solely by its electric engine before the vehicle's gas-powered internal combustion engine kicks in to recharge the electric engine's lithium-ion battery. Hence, the Volt is not technically an all-electric vehicle. But not to be outdone, Nissan delivered its own all-electric vehicle, the Leaf, to its first North American customer. Unlike Volt, the Leaf depends solely on its battery, which fully charged can go about 115 kilometers, according to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. More electric cars will follow, including the Ford Focus BEV battery electric vehicle in 2011. Whether consumers take to all-electric vehicles remains to be seen, given the lack of dedicated charging stations that may still fuel, quote, range anxiety, unquote, in many drivers. Tax breaks and other government incentives are helping early adopters, but driver satisfaction with the charging process, not to mention the vehicle's pickup and handling, will be crucial in determining whether electric cars are here to stay. Now, number 7 is a little controversial. Some people don't say it's science. I do, because it has to do with technology. WikiLeaks. The U.S. learned a hard lesson in data security on November 28th when WikiLeaks, an organization championing whistleblowers, began publishing what it claims will amount to more than 250,000 leaked U.S. embassy cables. This release was not the first, or even the second or third major WikiLeaks publication of the year. In April, it posted a video depicting a U.S. military helicopter attack on supposed insurgents in Iraq, and in July and October, it posted sensitive reports on the Afghan and Iraq wars. But Cablegate was apparently the final straw for the U.S. and its political allies. The documents describe international affairs from 300 embassies dated from 1966 to 2010, containing diplomatic analysis of world leaders, assessments of host countries, and internal discussions about international and domestic issues. Although no hacking seemed to be involved, many observers think that U.S. Army Private Bradley Manning simply copied the data and gave it to WikiLeaks. The Fuhrer shows that modern technology makes securing information difficult and retaliation easy. After WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange was arrested on December 7th in the UK based on unrelated allegations of supposed sex crimes, his supporters went on the offensive, launching cyber attacks against the websites of MasterCard, PayPal, Visa, and other organizations, as well as people perceived to have wronged Assange in his operations. And that brings us to number 6, a new direction for NASA. Yes, NASA's been already twice on the list, but this is actually having to do with outer space. Since the dawn of the U.S. space program, the nation has entrusted NASA and NASA alone to build and launch the rockets that carry its astronauts into orbit. That may soon change as part of a massive shakeup of the agency proposed by President Obama in February. Private companies would step in to ferry astronauts to the International Space Station after the space shuttle is retired in 2011, freeing NASA to set its sights on more distant destinations such as Mars. The proposal generated plenty of discussion and controversy among legislators and commentators, including the editors of Scientific American, but in September, Congress agreed in principle to modified version of Obama's plan. Meanwhile, the startup firm SpaceX completed a series of successful demonstrations in 2010 of its Falcon 9 rocket, which could someday find use as a space taxi to orbit for NASA astronauts. Okay, number 5, the eruption of the volcano in Iceland on March 20th. It had an unpronounceable name and kept erupting over subsequent weeks. I am going to attempt to pronounce it properly right now. Eyjafjallajökull, whose name means island mountain glacier for the ice sheet it melted, injected 250 million cubic meters of ash into the atmosphere, and its second major eruption on April 14th shut down air traffic in Europe for at least 6 days as the ash plume drifted over that continent, reaching more than 10 kilometers into the sky. The gritty ash posed too much of a risk to modern jet turbines, which could become clogged or flame out, and, besides the risk to life and limb, cost airlines and others more than $2.5 billion, or according to the European Commission. Eruptions on this scale and bigger are common, but they generally haven't happened in such important airspace. But ultimately, it's only a matter of time before Earth gives us a repeat performance. Volcanoes in Japan and the Pacific Northwest, for instance, are poised to go off any time, inevitably disrupting human activity. I said it. Okay. Number 4, synthetic life. Will March 26, 2010 go down in history as the dawn of man-made life? That's the day scientists at the J. Craig Venter Institute inserted an entirely synthesized genome into Mycoplasma capricollum cell and turned it into Mycoplasma mycoides. By March 29th, the artificial genetic instructions worked out just as well as natural ones, in fact, a little better. The stripped-down artificial genome enabled the altered microbe to grow slightly faster than its natural counterpart. For biologists in this field, the goal is not to create life per se, but to change organisms to make them useful. And by building a genome from scratch, synthetic biologists hope to gain a better understanding of basic genetic principles, such as why the order of genes along with the genome matters. But many scientists don't consider Venter's creation as lab-generated life, quote-unquote. And a presidential commission recently echoed that sentiment, concluding that such synthetic biology should be allowed to proceed given the possible benefits, although it cautioned appropriate safeguards that would be necessary. Still, the creation, dubbed Cynthia, marks another step in the long journey to man-made organisms. It currently resides in a freezer at the Venner Institute branch in Maryland, awaiting both the chance to be useful and for the judgment of history. And number three, major advances in HIV and AIDS prevention. The encouraging results from the Thai HIV vaccine trial late in 2009 boosted hope that the retrovirus could eventually be beaten. This year witnessed new strides in prevention. A tenofovir-containing vaginal gel, which we talked about on this show, could help women avoid infection even if their partners refuse to wear a condom. When women who use the gel as directed cut their risk of becoming infected by about 54% compared to a control group. For men who have sex with men, a group of especially high HIV/AIDS transmission rates, the same drugs that have helped millions of infected individuals manage their illness might help keep it at bay. Now, a November study showed that men who took a daily prophylactic dose of Truvada at least 90% of the time could reduce their risk of becoming infected by about 73%. Although such a regimen would be expensive and challenging to maintain over long duration, the results show the biological feasibility of such an approach. The best-known preventative strategy, however, went on display during the 2010 World Cup tournament in South Africa, where some 18% of adults may be HIV positive. There, the local government ordered 1 billion condoms, enough, organizers hoped, to keep the country covered for the duration of the event's celebration. Now, number two is the Haiti earthquake and the cholera outbreak. January's magnitude 7.0 earthquake created a long tail of death and destruction. Although the images of a wrecked capital city stemming in large part to a lack of enforceable building codes were stunning, the damage is still playing out nearly a year later. Cholera, Vibrio cholerae, has become widespread around the country, and cases are now being detected in the Dominican Republic, which shares the island of Hispaniola with Haiti, Cuba, and Florida. Within the borders of Haiti, more than 2,000 have died from cholera despite large-scale efforts to promote and distribute oral rehydration treatments and clean water. The 9-month lag between the earthquake and cholera outbreak may be linked to continued habitation of refugee camps. All told, the Tumbler has likely claimed more than 94,000 lives thus far. Another more insidious health threat has also likely been brewing since the quake. Quote, "The largest burden of disease after these events is probably mental health issues," unquote, said Columbia University epidemiologist Sandro Gallier. Prior to the earthquake, Haiti had limited medical and sanitation infrastructure, and despite the known risk of a large quake in that region, the country had little preparedness planning, especially when compared with Chile, which was hit with a magnitude 8.8 earthquake in February, but was much less deadly. And what made it to the number one science story? The Gulf of Mexico oil spill. On April 20th, a well-known blowout at BP's Macondo oil well set off an explosion on board the Deep Water Horizon rig floating about a mile above. The blast claimed 11 lives, sank the rig, and unleashed a 3-month deluge that spewed 750 million liters of crude oil and natural gas into the Gulf of Mexico. After several failed attempts to stem the relentless oil flow, BP capped the well on July 15th. The deepwater spill is already one of the worst natural disasters and will continue to harm marine and wildlife habitats for years to come. There has been plenty of blame to go around for the fiasco. In November, the National Commission on the BP Deepwater Horizon Oil Spill and Offshore Drilling concluded in their report, which you can find on PDF, that clear indicators of problems existed in the cement mixture used by Halliburton, one of the rig contractors hired by BP, to supposedly seal any gas leaks prior to the well's explosion. On December 15th, the U.S. Department of Justice filed a civil lawsuit against BP and 8 other companies claiming violations of federal regulations concerning the operation and safety of oil rigs. The suit asked the court for civil penalties under the Clean Water Act and to declare 8 of the defendants liable without limitation. Well, that does it for that top 10. And next, right after this music break, we're going to have the 10 insights of the decade, the insights that have changed the face of science since the dawn of the new millennium.
I push my finger. passed into my eyes. It's the only thing that slowly stops the ache, but it's made of all the things I have to take.
Invisibility cloaks and water on Mars. These are some of the biggest scientific breakthroughs of the past decade. The world's first quantum machine, a device that moves according to laws that govern the subatomic world, has been named the biggest scientific breakthrough of the year. Okay, now the machine topped the list of the most significant developments in science in 2010, along with the sequencing of Neanderthal DNA, advances in the HIV prevention, and the synthetic genome. Science Magazine, one of the world's leading research journals, also came up with a list of the top 10 scientific achievements of the decade, which includes the discovery of clear evidence of past water on Mars and huge advances in the search for other planets. Created by U.S. scientists at the University of California, Santa Barbara, the quantum machine consists of a tiny metal paddle invisible to the naked eye that dances to a quantum rhythm. After first cooling the paddle to the lowest possible energy state, the researchers coaxed it into a purely quantum mechanical state of motion. This meant it behaved in strange ways not seen in the macro world of classical mechanics. For instance, the device could be in two states at once, known as superpositions, so that it vibrated a little and a lot at the same time. The achievement by a team led by physicists Andrew Cleland and John Martinez was singled out as the single most impressive advance of 2010 by science. This year's breakthrough of the year represents the first time that scientists have demonstrated quantum effects in the motion of a human man-made object, said science writer Adrian Cho. On a conceptual level, that's cool because it extends quantum mechanics into a whole new realm. On a practical level, it opens up a variety of possibilities ranging from new experiments that meld quantum control over light, electrical currents, and motion to, perhaps someday, test the boundaries of quantum mechanics and our sense of reality. Now, here are 10 of these top insights that we were talking about. The first one being precision cosmology. Over the past decade, researchers have deduced a very precise recipe for the content of the universe, which consists of 4% ordinary matter, 23% dark matter, and 73% dark energy, as well as instructions for putting it all together. These advances have transformed cosmology into a precision science with a standard theory that now leaves very little room for other ideas. Metamaterials. By synthesizing materials with unconventional optical properties, physicists have pioneered new ways to guide and manipulate light, creating lenses that defy the fundamental limits on resolution. They've even begun constructing Harry Potter-style cloaks that can make an object invisible. The dark genome scientists discovered that genes account for just 1.5% of the whole. The rest of the genome, including small coding and non-coding RNAs, is proving to be just as important as the genes. Exoplanets. In the year 2000, researchers were aware of just 26 planets outside our solar system. By 2010, that number had jumped to 502 and still counting. Astronomers now expect to find many more Earth-like planets in the universe as better technology becomes available. For now, the sizes and orbits of larger planets already discovered are revolutionizing scientists' understanding of how planetary systems form and evolve. Ancient biomolecules. The realization that biomolecules like ancient DNA and collagen can survive for tens of thousands of years and provide important information about long-dead plants, animals, and humans has been a huge breakthrough for paleontology. Analysis of these tiny time machines can now reveal anatomical adaptations that skeletal evidence simply can't provide, such as the color of a dinosaur's feathers or how woolly mammoths withstood the cold. Water on Mars. Half a dozen missions to Mars over the past decade have provided clear evidence that the red planet once harbored enough water, either on it or just inside it, to alter rock formations and possibly sustain life. This Martian water was probably present around the time that life was beginning to appear on Earth, but there is still enough moisture on Mars today to encourage scientists seeking living, breathing microbes. Now, reprogramming cells. During the past decade, the notion that development is a one-way street has been turned on its head. Now researchers have figured out how to reprogram fully developed cells into so-called pluripotent cells that regain their potential energy to become any type of cell in the body. This technique has already been used to make cell lines from patients with rare diseases, but ultimately scientists hope to grow genetically matched replacement cells, tissues, and organs. The microbiome. A major shift in the way we view the microbes and viruses that call the human body home has led researchers to the concept of microbiome, or the collective genomes of the host and the other creatures that live on or inside it. Since 90% of the cells in our bodies are actually microbial, scientists are beginning to understand how significantly microbial genes can affect how much energy we absorb from our foods and how our immune systems respond to infections. Inflammation. Not long ago, inflammation was known as a simple sidekick to our healing machinery, briefly setting in to help immune cells rebuild tissue damage caused by trauma or infection. Today, however, researchers believe that inflammation is also a driving force behind the chronic diseases that will eventually kill nearly all of us, including cancer, Alzheimer's disease, osteosclerosis, diabetes, and obesity. Climate change. Researchers have found that many of their predictions about climate change in terms of temperature changes have been correct this decade, according to science. You want to know more about it? Check out all these topics on Science's Search, and you will be amazed. They have some great pictures as well. And here we have Ripley's Believe It or Not. They search the globe for the ultimate in unusual oddities, strange stories, and terrific true tales. After reading and reviewing hundreds of stories from headlines around the world in 2010, the experts and weirdologists at Ripley's are releasing their top 10 strange stories of 2010. They range from the bizarre to the unbelievable, but are true. Bearded woman finds son. Vivian Wheeler was born with hypertrichosis, werewolf syndrome, and as a hermaphrodite, also known as bisex, both male and female reproductive organs, and was told she couldn't have children. But at 29, she gave birth to a boy who was promptly taken away from her by her boyfriend and put up for adoption. In 2010, after years of searching, Richard Lorenk found his mother and they were reunited. Ripley the dog. The living, breathing, big pile of fur found in a ditch in Houma, Louisiana, turned out to be a one-year-old poodle. As he was being shaved, the vet decided to name the pooch Ripley because, believe it or not, there was a dog under there. The before and after photos garnered worldwide attention, and less than 6 weeks after being discovered, Ripley was well enough to be adopted. Longest high school football game ever. The high school football game in Texas turned into an endurance battle as Jacksonville beat Nacogdoches in 12 overtimes, 84-81, breaking the old record of 9 extra frames. The game ended at 12:54 a.m. after the boys battled for more than 5 hours. Spray on clothes. Forget about all the medical breakthroughs in 2010, for surely it will become known as the year that scientists developed an instant sprayable non-woven fabric that can be sprayed onto a nude body to form clothes that not only cover but can be taken off, washed, and worn again. Deep fried beer. In a competition at the Texas State Fair, Mark Zabel unveiled fried beer. In a patented process, he put beer into a doughy packet and deep fries it. The quick fry hardens the crust, but the beer remains a fully potent brew. Those who sampled it were carded. Dead body in a car for 10 months. Ugh! Shortly after, a homeless woman in California was befriended by a motorist, she died unexpectedly. The driver, not knowing what to do with the body, drove it around for 10 months next to a box of baking soda to help negate the smell. The corpse was discovered by police, who smelled the stench, looked in the car, and saw a leg poking out from under a pile of clothes. Man shot in the head finds out 5 years later. A man living in Germany walked around and functioned normally for 5 years without noticing that he had been shot in the head. The .22 caliber bullet was found when the man went to the doctor to have what he thought was a cyst removed. All he could remember was that it probably happened in 2005 at a New Year's Eve party and that he was, quote, very drunk, unquote. Dog chews off man's toe. A 48-year-old Michigan man credited his dog, Kiko, with saving his life by chewing off his deceased big toe as he laid passed out in a drunken daze. The terrier gnawed off his right big toe, which turned out to be a badly infected due to type 2 diabetes. The dog ate off the diseased tissue and left the rest untouched. Woman tries to be fattest. Ugh! The 42-year-old mother of two wants to become the world's heaviest living woman. Donna Simpson currently weighs more than 600 pounds, and her desire is to top 1,000 pounds. She works as a model on a website called SupersizeBombshells.com, where the curious pay to watch videos of her eating or walking. She spends nearly $750 per month in groceries for herself and admits that she is as hungry for attention as she is for the junk food she eats every day. Cat predicts death. Oscar the cat lives at a nursing home and rehabilitation in Providence, Rhode Island. He roams the halls and is generally unsociable, spends little time with anyone who has more than a few hours to live. Now, he rarely errs in his predictions, and this year extended his predicting streak to 50. He senses death and cuddles with the elderly patients as they pass. If you want to know more about this, go on Ripley Entertainment at ripleys.com. And now for our special presentation. A special treat just for you on the first broadcast of the year, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, written by Jules Verne, starring Gene Lockhart and Bill Woodson, with host Dennis Morgan. Stay tuned. If you've never heard this original broadcast before, you are in for a real treat.
Family Theater presents Dennis Morgan and Gene Lockhart. From Hollywood, the Mutual Network, in cooperation with Family Theater, presents transcribed 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, starring Gene Lockhart. To introduce the drama, here is your host, Dennis Morgan.
Years before their appearance, Jules Verne foretold the submarine, the balloon, the airplane, the telephone, the long-range projectile, and many other inventions. But perhaps his greatest writing achievement was the complex but very human character of Captain Nemo, tragic star of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. In this man we glimpse Homer's Ulysses, Shakespeare's Hamlet, and ourselves, our dreams, our disillusionments, above all, our instinctive yearning for good. These are the things that make Captain Nemo and his great adventure timeless. And so it is with pride and pleasure that Family Theater presents Gene Lockhart as Captain Aronnax in Jules Verne's beloved classic, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
The Earth does not need new continents. It needs new men.
My name is Pierre Aronnax. I am an assistant professor in the Museum of Natural History in Paris. The year is 1866. Delving into the unknown, as I do, there is little that surprises me. And yet, today, in this modern life, unbelievable newspaper headlines shock the world.
Extra, extra, steamer attacked by sea serpent. Read all about it. Extra, extra, another ship attack, Navy to sea monster, extra, extra.
I was in my New York apartment at the conclusion of my most recent scientific tour and had planned to return to Paris with my valuable collection of specimens when...
Professor Aronnax?
Yes, Conseil, what is it?
Commander Farragut of the United States Navy to see you, sir.
Commander Farragut?
Professor Aronnax, this is a great pleasure.
Oh, well... Believe me, Commander Farragut, the feeling is mutual. In fact, I'm somewhat overcome. To have a man of your reputation seek out an obscure professor...
Quite the contrary, sir. My government would like to see France represented in the expedition in pursuit of the monster.
You mean you wish me to...
I am holding a cabin at your disposal on the President Lincoln, sir. We leave Brooklyn Pier in 3 hours.
You have a fine ship, Commander.
Yes, we're well armed, Professor.
Didn't I see a breech-loading cannon atop your forecastle?
You did, sir. But my best weapon of all, Professor, is Ned Land.
Huh?
Oh, Ned, come over here, if you please.
Aye, aye, Commander Farragut. At your service, sir.
Professor Aronnax, Ned is known all over the seven seas as the Prince of Harpooners. If and when we track down the sea monster, he'll show you some real action.
Prove a real test for your talents, Mr. Land. It's a fabulous beast indeed that can stove in the side of a ship.
You're speaking of the Scotia, I take it. Begging your pardon, Professor. If there should be a sea monster that big, that mighty, then Ned Land wants to be the man to harpoon it.
That's the way our voyage began. A strong ship, hand-picked men, and a vast curiosity and determination to end this terror of the seas. On and on we went, past the Marquesas, the Sandwich Islands, across the Tropic of Cancer, and headed for the China Seas. And then...
Ahoy there! The very thing we're looking for! On our weather beam, the sea monster! Yeah!
can't harpoon it, sir. The monster's running circles around us. We can't get near enough for me to use my harpoon.
Right the helm, ahead as you are.
It's no use, Commander. The monster's going twice as fast as we are.
I know it, sir. There's only one thing left to do. Stand and fight.
Up to the forecastle cannon, man.
Aye, sir.
The forecastle gun was loaded and slewed into position. The President Lincoln was running at half speed now, and the sea monster seemed content to follow at a certain distance as though mocking us. The gunner, steady of eye, grave of face, took long and careful aim and then...
Fire!
Watch out, sir! The monster's closing in on us! That shot made him mad! He's gonna ram us!
He's falling overboard!
And so is Ned Land!
I trust that the state of your health is improving, Professor Aronnax.
Where am I?
Aboard my submarine, the Nautilus.
Submarine?
Who are you?
You may address me as Captain Nemo, Mr. Land.
Captain?
Submarine? Then you're...
I am your sea monster, oh, Prince of Harpooners.
Captain, how do you know so much about us?
You told me, Professor. You were somewhat delirious for a while. Thus I learned all about yourself, your servant Conseil, and Ned Land. I also know that you are from the frigate President Lincoln, which deliberately invaded my privacy, attacked me. You are prisoners of war. By rights, I should place you back on deck and submerge, forgetting your existence.
Why, you wouldn't dare. That wouldn't be civilized.
I am not what you so glibly call a civilized man, Professor Aronnax.
Then what is to be our fate, Captain Nemo?
I am not altogether heartless. I do have a certain sense of pity for any living thing, but of course you must live under my law. Give your word to cause no trouble, nor try to escape.
Stay with you? For how long?
For the rest of your life, Mr. Lamb.
Do you know what you ask, Captain? We're never to see our country again? Our friends? Our families?
You'll see far more fascinating country underwater. Renouncing the world is not so painful as you seem to think.
You're simply offering us the choice between life and death.
Just that.
Then we have no choice. Captain Nemo, we will abide by your wishes.
It won't be as bad as you think, gentlemen. You, Professor, will find your own published works in my library, and I will show you marvels undersea that even you haven't dreamed of. You will live in the best of quarters, enjoy the finest food.
Yes, but without freedom.
There is always a price, sir. Be glad that yours is no higher.
We were fed, housed in comfortable quarters, and we slept. But little did I dream of the wonders that tomorrow would bring. Right after breakfast, Ned and Conseil were taken to their permanent quarters while I was escorted to a luxurious suite, adjoining the quarters of Captain Nemo himself. As I stared about me in amazement, I heard the strains of a pipe organ in the next room, and venturing in, I found myself in a magnificent drawing room and the captain at the keyboard of the organ.
Good morning, Professor Aronnax. Oh. You seem somewhat surprised to learn that I practice the arts as well as the sciences. Well,
I must confess, Captain Nemo, I scarcely expected to find you a musician of such inspired music.
Inspired?
Well, I see, too, that you have priceless works of art on the walls. A Madonna by Raphael, and a Virgin there by Leonardo da Vinci, a Nymph by Correggio, and an Assumption by Murillo.
I see that the professor of natural history has not neglected his cultural training.
Even a museum professor can have taste, sir, and a zest for life, an appreciation of beauty.
I like you, Professor Aronnax. I like courage in a quiet man. Native pride. You have no answer for this turn of events?
I must admit, I don't know what to say.
Then say nothing, but watch instead. I have another wonder to show you. I go over here to press a lever.
Great heavens! The whole side of the submarine is sliding back. We're doomed.
Do not fear, sir. We are protected from the sea by several layers of heavy glass. Behold. Behold the army of the sea, Professor. The fish seem to float in liquid light. Do they not?
It's unbelievable.
But true. The banded mullet, the Japanese scumbrus, the beautiful mackerel, all sown by the hand of him who created all living things.
Him? Then you...
Believe in God. Look out there, my dear professor. In the face of such wonders, how could I possibly not believe in such a deity?
But I don't understand. You gave up the world...
Merely because I forsook man does not mean I forsook God. In the sea, I sense the weaving of creation on every hand.
But with this philosophy, how can you forget man? How and why?
Why? Why? It is mankind which has forgotten, not I. They've forgotten their God by making unjust laws, tearing one another to pieces, destroying. Professor, you and your friend shall accompany me on my next hunting expedition. If you will kindly don these India rubber diving suits and weighted boots, we'll soon be off on the hunt.
Hunt? In diving suits?
Captain Nemo has promised undreamed wonders, Ned.
I can believe that, sir.
We've now arrived at the forests of the lost island of Crespa, gentlemen. You have your suits on. Now please put the helmets in place. I am about to close the waterproof door.
We were in utter darkness. The Rouquayrol apparatus began operating the moment our helmets were fixed firmly in place, and I breathed with ease. Now, I was about to step into a completely new element, the sinister unknown, led by a man who, for all I knew, was mad. A second door, located in the outer of the shell of the Nautilus, slid back, and in another moment, I was treading the floor of the ocean. My dear friends, how can I describe the sight that met my eyes? A fantastic dream? No, more like an emotion. Yes, an emotion, that's it. I moved through unbelievable beauty, no longer feeling the drag of my clothing and weighted shoes. The water acted like a prism for the early morning sun, so that we walked in the radiance of the seven solar colors. I could see the silver sand shimmering away to a distance of 150 yards, and dotted with star shell, flowers, and rocks, and shells, and pulpy of every shade and formation. But what if my colleagues could see me now? They wouldn't believe it. No.
We're approaching the old Spanish galleon. But here, friends, look. Look as I open this gigantic chest. There. Look. Gold. Plenty of it. Sparkling, glinting in cold salt water. My eternal bank. I fill the small chest we brought along. And now, my dear professor, we'll go to my pearl beds.
Captain, all these riches we saw today, you can use only so much. What good is the rest unless you help your fellow man?
Professor Arana, you are my guest, an onlooker. I do not desire your advice.
Oh, but it seems such a waste, sir. With so much need in the world...
Enough! Yes, there is need. I am and never shall be one with unfortunates.
Oh, Captain, look out there. A diver. He's looking in at us.
Oh, yes. Yes, we're near shore.
But what does he want?
You asked a question, Professor. You shall have your answer.
Oh,
And even as I watched, a crew member in a diving suit appeared outside the window and gave the native diver the small treasure chest taken from the Spanish galleon. The swimmer returned to the window, humbly saluted Captain Nemo, who returned the gesture, and then the diver darted upward with his treasure. I turned and looked at Nemo.
What more do you want of me, Professor Aronoff? A confession written in heart's blood that though I hate the world, I love my fellow man.
I couldn't answer him. If ever I saw tragedy burned across a man's face, I saw it in Nemo's. I could now understand his bitter philosophy, his moods blowing hot and cold, like destroying, searing winds. And then, a week later, Ned Conseil and I saw another side of Nero's nature. He had sighted a mysterious man-o-war. The ship fired at us.
They're firing at us. Let me at that periscope.
Stand back, Mr. Land. Ship of an accursed nation. You recognize me, don't you? Fear me. Now, my vengeance. Torpedo one, fire!
No, Captain, no! They won't have a chance! The man-o-war seemed to disintegrate. Captain Nemo watched it sink. An archangel of hatred. Then he turned and entered his quarters. I followed him as though hypnotized. I saw him uncover a picture on the far wall, a portrait of a young woman and two beautiful children. Before this little group, Nemo spread out his arms and then...
Almighty God, enough. Enough.
After that catastrophic occurrence, the Nautilus moved in more and more of a dream world. And then Ned came to me with his plan.
We're escaping tonight, Professor.
Escape? Are we in sight of land?
I just took the Recknan. There are hills 20 miles to the east of us.
20 miles? It might as well be 200. You know very well that I'm not a swimmer, Ned.
You won't have to swim, sir. We'll take the small boat. We'll meet at 10 tonight.
Heavens knows I'm with you, Ned. Lay your plans. I'll meet you at 10.
I went to my quarters, dressed in my stoutest sea garments, collected my notes, and settled down to await the appointed time. And then, music. From the hands of a tormented soul longing to break its earthly bonds. Such music as could only come from Captain Nemo himself. And then, my heart froze in terror. He was in the drawing room, the very room I must cross in order to make my escape. I made my way to the drawing room. The room was in a greenish half-light. Nemo sat before the pipe organ, playing as though music were his last avenue of expression in life. I held my breath. I passed in back of him. I reached for the far door.
Stop!
Captain Nemo arose and came straight toward me. I slammed the heavy door, bolted it, and ran to meet Ned.
Professor! Professor, is that you?
Yes, 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 let us go.
Aye, sir, we have surfaced to take on fresh air.
They're coming after us!
Quick, up on deck! Come on, Professor, hurry!
A storm! We're in a storm!
Storm, nothing. It's a maelstrom. Quick, another small boat.
Oh, no, the waves. We're caught in the maelstrom. We're going down.
You're safe, Professor. Oh. Quite safe now.
Fosse?
The same, sir. Oh. And here's Ned, too. He brought us through the maelstrom safely.
We're in a fisherman's hut on the Lofoten Islands, Professor.
But the Nautilus?
She was caught fair in the middle of it and went down, sir. And it's no better than she deserved, if you ask me.
If anyone could survive such a storm, Captain Nemo could. At least, I hope so.
You hope so?
Yes, Ned. After traveling 20,000 leagues under the sea with Nemo, I hope he lives on to conquer his hatred for the world, forget vengeance in his love for the oppressed. As Ecclesiastes questioned 6,000 years ago, that which is far off and exceeding deep, who can find it out? I hope that Captain Nemo can find his answer.
From Hollywood, Family Theater has presented 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, starring Gene Lockhart. Dennis Morgan was your host. Others in our cast were Bill Woodson as Nemo, Whitfield Connor, Jack Lloyd, and Michael Hayes. The script was adapted from Jules Verne's classic by Virginia M. Cook, with music composed and conducted by Harry Zimmerman, and was directed and transcribed for Family Theater by Joseph F. Mansfield. This series of Family Theater broadcasts is made possible by the thousands of you who feel the need for this type of program, by the Mutual Network, which has responded to this need, and by the hundreds of stars of stage, screen, and radio who give so unselfishly of their time and talent to appear on our Family Theater stage. To them and to you, our humble thanks. Family Theater is broadcast throughout the world and originates in the Hollywood studios of the world's largest network. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.
Wow, what a great story. I remember the first time I saw that movie. Anyway, this brings Savage Science to a close for this week. Next week, there will be a bit of a story on Garrett Lisi's theory of everything. It would have been this week, but it was a lot longer than I expected when I put it together, and I really feel that he deserves more attention than just a few minutes and a blurb. So, that's for next week, and thank you very much for listening. Thank you to Hawk Productions' Dennis Baum for the great intro that we use every week, and the fantastic illustration for the show logo by Nick Palucco. Until next week, keep powder in your pants dry, and happy trails to you.